How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter. Hope you're doing well. We have a really cool show this evening. This book, which somebody told me about months and months and months ago, called City Under One Roof, it is a novel, because that's on the front of every piece of fiction now, a novel, by Iris Yamashita. Yamashita is how you pronounce her name, is really fabulous. And it's loosely based on the fact that in this remote small town in Alaska, there is this weird town where everybody lives in one building, yeah. And there's very little access to and from. And Iris saw a documentary about it years ago, and she turned it into a book. But Iris herself has a pretty interesting story. So we will talk to her in a minute. But first, we've got the wonderfully talented Lauren Larson helping us. Claude's got shockingly better things to do than chatter on books. David Aldridge, Jamie McIntyre, welcome back, guys. How's everybody?
Good to be here.
Good. Okay, Jamie, can you put on your CNN headlines version, which means 45 seconds, and break down for us what happened in 24 hours in Russia and Ukraine?
Well, we got the version from Yevgeny Prigozhin today, and I'll tell you his version in a nutshell. It wasn't a coup. They didn't want to depose Vladimir Putin, but they were very upset that they'd been attacked by Russian forces, and the defense ministry tried to force them, the Wagner Group mercenaries, to join the regular army. So in Prigozhin's words, this is just a peaceful protest. They got in their tanks and stuff and drove across the border, took over the regional military headquarters and headed toward Moscow. But Prigozhin says when they got closer, they realized it was going to be a big bloody battle and they didn't want to have bloodshed. So they said, we made our point, and we turned around and went back. And, oh, by the way, sorry, we shot down those helicopters and planes on the way, but they bombed us first.
Excellent headlines version. And the head of the Wagner Group, say his name again.
Yevgeny Prigozhin.
Thank you, Prigozhin.
I
studied Russian for a year. I can't do any of it. Tell me if I got any of this wrong. Started out selling hot dogs on the street in St. Petersburg, became a caterer, which is how he met Putin, started to get a lot of big contracts to do a lot of big meal services, somehow makes the leap from caterer to head of a mercenary group, which has been operating for some years, right, around the world, doing horrible, ruthless, terrible stuff, but allowing Moscow to say, hey, not us.
A lot of places in Africa and in Syria.
Yeah, and really a great cover for Putin, et cetera, because they could say it was not us that did these terrible things. And it's pretty remarkable to watch the guy, because it reminds me a little bit of somebody who used to hold a very high elected office here in the country, in which he is a master of media. He knows how to use social media. He knows how to deliver a message on camera. It's a little scary.
But he's also a very, very brutal thug.
Yes. Okay. Chatter on horrible things.
Right.
Some of the stuff he has done in the past and his people have done in the past, the brutality with which they've treated some of their enemies and others, pretty awful. David, from a non-national security person standpoint, what did this look like or sound like over the weekend, or did it not even cross your radar?
Oh, it very much crossed the radar. It sounded an awful lot like when, I can't remember exactly who it was, tried to overthrow Gorbachev, right?
And right.
Didn't 90. Quite work.
Yeah, long time ago.
Yeah. So that's what it sounded like. And it certainly sounded like I don't want to say they chickened out, but they saw the odds were long and didn't want to follow through.
There are so many. Okay, we're going to like blow through all the things I had on our agenda. there are so many things we'll never know, because we'll never know the real stories. But there are so many things that might have happened. And I can't remember what the occasion was, Jamie, but a long time ago, somebody was briefing me on why the Russians were not taking the United States seriously, whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever. And one of the things the Russians were saying to our people was, when you've got an enemy in your grasp, you don't treat them brutally enough. You don't grab their relatives and take videos that you've got their relatives held captive and show them we're going to torture your relatives if you don't stop doing these things. There's so many different reasons that he may have said, take a pause here. We're not going to Moscow after all. But I've got to believe behind the scenes there was a fair amount of that going on. Because there was
a report suggesting that one of the things they had done was threaten Prigozhin's relatives. But there are all kinds of conspiracy theories going on in Russia. One of them is that this whole thing is a giant ruse so that Prigozhin can go to Belarus, take some of his troops there, and then with plausible deniability, mount cross-border raids in the north to distract the Ukrainians. And also it was a ruse so that Putin could clear out some of these generals that are underperforming because of the criticism that Prigozhin is in. But as you said, we're not going to know until, you know, 10-20 years from now when someone writes the definitive book after the files are declassified.
Put on your list, Jamie. I love conspiracy theories. I absolutely love them. Okay, David, before that happened over the weekend, I was going to ask you about the NBA draft, and then we're going to have to spend a little bit of time on the NHL draft, where I am headed in 2 days, because this is Chatter on Sports. I asked you this before when you and I were just talking on the phone, but how once in a generation, once in a lifetime, is our number one pick, who happens to be from France, which I have a hard time getting over?
Victor Wembanyama. He's the best prospect since LeBron James, which was 20 years ago. So that tells you how long it's been since somebody this good was in the draft. When people tell you, most of the time when people talk about players in the draft, they say, well, you know, maybe he'll be an all-star someday. He's got enough talent to be an all-star. But when they say he's going to be the best player in the league, it's just a matter of when. That's different. And that's what's different about this guy. He does everything that everybody else has done in the history of the game, except he's 7 feet four. He's 7 feet five in shoes, and he can do everything. He shoots it really well. He passes it extremely well. He defends extremely well. There's just nobody his size has ever done all of the things that he can do. And so you don't know what that is going to look like on an NBA floor. You just know it's going to look different than anything you've ever seen.
Right. Okay, let's make this geopolitical. Back in the day when I was in high school outside Pittsburgh, it was a really, really huge deal because there was a kid. His first name was Tim. I can't remember his last name. I'm sorry. And he's a pretty good basketball player in Western Pennsylvania, but he wasn't good enough for the pros. And he went and lived and played in Europe for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that's where you went when you couldn't play here. Right. When did Europe become this hotbed of producing incredible talent?
Oh, it's certainly been the last 30 years since the onset, since the Dream Team in 92. Kind of brought American basketball over the pond to the rest of the world, and the rest of the world saw how wonderful it was and said, well, we can do that. Why don't we try to do that? And everybody, there were several, don't get me wrong, there were several countries that were already very good. The Russians were already very good. The Yugoslavian team was very good until Yugoslavia broke up and then it kind of splintered. But the kind of regular yearly cavalcade of European players and players from South America and players from Africa, that has been in the last 20 years or so, to the point now where a quarter of the league is from outside the United States.
That's amazing.
It's only going to get bigger. It's not going to get smaller.
Which I like. I like it that it's more international, more global. Oh, I think of so many things. So Griner's not says she's not going to go back to Russia unless she's playing for the U.S. team.
Correct. And she should. Why on earth would you go back there, if you were under any circumstances? I mean, I don't think it's brave of her to even say she'd go for, you know, to represent her country. But even then, I'm not sure I would go back. I just don't.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Okay. Switching gears to the NHL draft, which occurs Wednesday evening.
Nothing about the NHL draft. So whatever you're going to ask me, I'm not going to know the answer to.
No, I'm asking, maybe you all want me to call in with some color commentary or something like that. I'm going to be there.
You're going to be at, where is the draft? I'm sorry.
Nashville. Or Nashville.
Oh, of course.
Nash Vegas is my friend Jamie Sterling, not Jamie McIntyre, calls it Nash Vegas. Yeah.
Well, that should be fun. I mean, I'm a null set when it comes to the NHL draft, so I can't help you with anything that you have.
I would commend to people, I'm actually going to link something later tonight, first thing tomorrow, and I'm not this, but everyone should read Barry Zwerluga's piece today from the Washington Post, in which he said, now that Dan Snyder is on his way out, people need to start looking at Ted Leonsis and looking at the Lerners and saying, what are you doing with the other big teams?
Well, some of us have been doing it already. So
exactly. Okay.
The last couple of years. Nice of you to catch up, Gary.
Because this is a podcast about books, I'm going to make a quick recommendation on this subject.
Go.
One of my favorite books about thinking clearly and rational thinking is called The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis.
Oh, we love Michael Lewis.
He has a chapter about how the Houston Rockets ended up almost not drafting Jeremy Lin.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Because of the way they rate players and how confirmation bias and other biases blind them to sometimes to the talents or overrate other talents. It's just if you're into sports and you're into basketball and you're into rational logical thinking,
yeah,
it's a very interesting chapter. You can probably find the chapter online somewhere without having to buy the book. I'm sorry, I didn't say that.
No, it's very true and it's very accurate and it's applicable to all sports, baseball too, basketball, football. We all have biases and they influence our thinking.
It's true about life.
Yes.
Like, David, if we talked about this before, the incredible influence of all the gambling on all sports, all the time, everywhere.
Yes, we've talked about that. But what would you like to know?
Well, I don't know. I just was listening to something over the weekend. But, you know, somebody, I don't even know. And I won't say his name if I could even remember because it would be unfair. But people who are, you know, on TV, on websites, on all sorts of places, doing official commentary for them, but they also happen to have a relationship with some of the big gambling sites. Mm-hmm. And so what they say has undue influence. It starts to get really murky, I think.
I think it's very murky. And it doesn't matter who it is. I just think gambling in general is an area where you leave yourself open to questioning, even if what you're doing or saying is completely benign and above board, because everyone is so sensitive to whatever Vegas says is important that they just react to it immediately. And so you see that, again, player says, I'm not going to play because of whatever reason. The line goes crazy up and down, you know, so or someone gets hurt or something. You know, it's always about whatever information people think is valid information, they believe that influences the lines. And again, I get that people gamble. We can't relitigate that.
Yeah.
I just think it's silly to gamble on things that are in the control of 18 to 22 year old human beings.
I just remember my father-in-law used to sit at the front of the TV, and every time there was a call he didn't like in a football game, he'd grumble that the refs had been paid off.
Sure.
But now, when I'm watching baseball with my wife and there's a really obviously bad call by the umpire where the ball goes way outside the strike zone, according to the pitch tracker, she always suggests that maybe the umpire has a FanDuel or DraftKings account.
You know. It's a wonderfully, sitting next to Roberta at a baseball game, which I've done recently, it's a wonderfully schizophrenic experience.
Yes.
On one hand, she knows a lot about baseball. Mm-hmm. And there are people from the Nats organization coming up to her and like, yeah, Roberta, what do you think of X, Y, or Z or whatever? But she really knows baseball. And then on the other hand, the Nats were doing well when she was sitting next to my husband, Brian. And then in between innings, because I get bored, I switch seats, and she claimed that's why the Nats lost. So...
Well, that's a correlation causation, which is our main biases. You know, people think confirmation bias is like the mother of all biases, but I would tell you that it's correlation doesn't equal causation because most of the things we believe, we do one thing and something happens, you know, clearly there must be a relationship.
Right.
Yeah. Because
we did it.
Yeah. I don't know. The older I get, the more superstitious I get, and I'm usually right. Okay, we're going to talk about a couple of tiny little book things before Iris joins us. I gave up weeks and weeks and weeks ago talking about all these ridiculous book banning efforts by primarily five states in the country. You can guess which ones they are, because it was too depressing and there was too much of it. So a little thing popped up the other day. So Governor J.B. Pritzker from Illinois, I don't know J.B., I know the Pritzker family, so God bless him. He signed a piece of legislation outlining the banning of books, which I think is fantastic. And I'm not really sure why, but I remember going to Chicago many times and doing various educational related things in different jobs. But I want to read some of this. And I wonder, I've not had a chance to check and see what happened to JB. There's JB for you two who don't know what he looks like. Takes effect January 1, says public libraries must adopt the American Library Association's Library Bill of Rights or their own statement prohibiting book banning to be eligible for state money. I mean, good for him going right to where it matters, which is the money. he talked a lot about the American Library Association. In March, they said there were 1,269 demands to censor library books and resources in 2022, marking the highest number of attempted book bans. This is from CNN. I want to give credit where credit's due. Highest number of attempted book bans since the association began compiling the data more than 20 years ago. So in the face of kind of overwhelming ban books, et cetera, he did this. And I say, shout out to the governor.
Well, good for him. He's probably going to run for president someday.
Who isn't? Every one of these knuckleheads that has ever been elected to office, every single one of them.
They all think they can be president. Right?
They look in the mirror in the morning and they hear hail to the chief. And by the way, look at some of the people who have been president, and there's reason to think, David, you could run. Oh, my God, this would be so good for this show, Dave. You could run for president.
I could. I'm not going to, though.
Why would you not run for president? What's the biggest reason you would not run for president? And don't say, because I wouldn't win. That's not a good reason not to run for president.
My favorite. No, I could probably win. Well, my favorite line of all time is.
Don't write this down.
The fall of 1963. This was like September of 63.
You weren't born.
No, I wasn't born. But this is, I believe this is from What It Takes, but I don't know if it is. Where Kennedy clearly was getting ready to run for reelection.
Right.
Barry Goldwater clearly was going to run for reelection. And they actually had this discussion. I don't know if it was face to face or if their aides had done it, where they would go around the country and they would just have debates like Lincoln and Douglas.
Right.
And it actually was gaining some traction. Now, who knows if it would have actually come to pass or not. But there was one day where, for some reason, Barry Goldwater was in the White House, in the Oval Office, and Jack Kennedy looks at him. And I can't say it even on a podcast, but he just says, "So, you want this bleeping job, huh?" It's pointless. It's ridiculous to even contemplate what having that job would entail on a daily basis. It's not something.
I don't think it is. And I think we're on to something here. First of all, you could win.
Of course I could win, but
that's the
Groucho Marx line. Who on earth would want to be in a country where I could be elected president?
A lot of people. Again, we look at some of the predecessors and go, well, this could be a lot better. I think one of the single, we were talking about Prigozhin earlier and a former senior elected official of this country, the ability to be comfortable in media of all kinds is huge. Absolutely huge.
Yes, I know all of that. I've thought about not president, but other things short of president. And then you go, could I do that? Yeah, I probably could. I mean, I could probably get elected. Could I do it? I have no earthly idea. I wouldn't know until I found out.
Trust me. I've been pretty close to those offices on occasion.
No, you know what it is? I don't want to go to people that I don't know and ask them to give me money. That would be very distasteful to me.
David, the money would pour in.
Yeah, but you still
only have to do that if you're elected to Congress. If you're elected to a representative, you just spend your whole 2 years
raising
money for your next election.
Totally true. Okay, yeah. Jamie McIntyre, what's the number one reason you would not run for president?
Well, the job sucks, actually. that's the main reason.
You could still do this
podcast. It sounds like it's a lot of glamour and, you know, flying around on Air Force One. It's very hard to get anything done. You're constantly being demonized by one side or the other.
So what?
Well, as I said, it pays $400,000 a year, which is good for a lot of people, but it's not like you're in the NBA.
Right.
Jamie, taxes. I hate to break this to you, honey, but you're not going to be in the NBA anytime soon.
You got to pay taxes on all that money too. But, you know, do I think I could actually do the job? If you asked me when I was a little bit younger, I would have said, absolutely not. I'm not qualified to do that. But after seeing some of the occupants of the office, I think someone with common sense and empathy and compassion and who would listen to smarter people than them, I think you could actually do the job. So if you want to start a PAC or something,
there you go.
We could have a lot of candidates and a big choice of candidates for the presidency if we did not have the Electoral College.
Yes.
The Electoral College basically is the reason we ended up with a two-party system. Mm-hmm. Because under the Electoral College, it's not like it's unlikely to win as a third party.
It's impossible.
It's basically impossible.
Impossible, yeah.
And every time somebody says they're going to run as a third party, I just slap myself in the side of the head and wonder why they're doing it. Because all it can do is ensure that maybe the most popular candidate doesn't win.
Right. Okay, we'll wrap it up with this because Iris is here now and she's going, what?
Well,
so often.
Not going to be here for long if we keep talking about this crap.
No, we have to really worry where these conversations go right about 20 minutes because that's usually when the authors beam in and they're like, what? What show am I on? We'll come back to this because I disagree with both of you completely. The time has come for a third-party candidate. All right. We are welcoming to Chatter on Books, Iris Yamashita. Please tell me I pronounced that correctly.
Yes, you did.
Yay.
I sometimes don't pronounce it correctly.
Yeah, my husband never spells my names correctly. So welcome to Chatter on Books. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
And I mean, I'm sorry, David and Jamie, please say hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, David and Jamie. It's so nice to meet you virtually.
Yes, you too.
So, Iris, this wonderful book, City Under One Roof, a novel. Okay, we'll ask you this, Iris, because you know books. Maybe you understand why. When and how did it start that publishers made you put on the cover of your book a novel? This did not exist 20 years ago, but now every book that is a novel has it written on the cover, a novel.
I actually don't know because that was my first book and that was stuck on there. I didn't put it on there, but I imagine so it's that you know it's not a nonfiction book because that could easily have been the title of a nonfiction book.
It could. Live Together, Die Alone. It absolutely could. Okay, the book is fabulous. We will talk lots about it, but we've had so many authors on the show and they always have interesting backgrounds and we've had, you know, people who wanted to be astronauts and we've had a lot of authors, David, right, who were lawyers. That seems to be a common, like, get out of lawyering and get into writing. But you were on a path to be an engineer. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I had, I got a master's degree in mechanical engineering.
Okay, full stop. What does that mean? What can you do? Can you build things? Can you make things? Can you fix my car?
I can't do anything right now. I think I was smarter when I was in college. I majored in bioengineering when I was my undergrad, and I imagined that I would be making like sci-fi arms and, you know, artificial limbs and things like that, but it didn't turn out that way. And when I was looking at job prospects, actually, bioengineering was relatively new as a major, and it was basically you can work at a pharmaceutical company and make syringes or something like that, which didn't sound that exciting to me. So you know, I didn't know what to do, and I went on and got a master's degree, and I still didn't do anything.
You could dust off that resume today and make a fortune, absolute fortune. You could fund the presidential campaigns of David Aldridge and Jamie McIntyre, which would be great.
I can barely calculate my tip these days, so I don't think it's
okay.
Now.
So I've read and heard and listened to a lot of your fabulous interviews. Writing was always a hobby?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, when I was young, I had to hide from my parents that I was reading all my books about the Black Stallion and Black Beauty, and I had to hide the horse books literally behind, you know, Sigmund Freud discusses the whatever on sexuality from my parents because I was not supposed to be reading fun stuff. Was your hobby a secret, your writing hobby, or did your parents know?
I think they knew, but, you know, as long as it was a hobby, it was okay. But because, you know, my parents are Asian, they would not let me make that a career. Mm-hmm. So that's why I went into engineering. I remember distinctly my father having a conversation with me when I was taking writing classes, and this was on my own dime and just doing it on the side, and him telling me, like, you're wasting your money and, you know, don't do that. Focus on something else.
But you kept doing it. Okay, wait, David and then Jamie, did you ever hide anything from your parents that you were really interested in but you thought they might disapprove?
I can't think of anything. Well, you mean besides the Playboy magazines? Is that?
It's like you think your parents didn't know.
I'm sure they knew. Of course they knew. But other than that, no, not really.
Okay, Jamie?
When I was younger, I managed to get an old black and white TV in my room, and I was strictly prohibited from watching it after bedtime. But as soon as my mom would go to bed, I'd put a towel under the door to block the light. And turn it on and watch Perry Mason the ones that came on at like 11:30 at night after the evening news.
I love Hamilton Burger's career.
You know, Perry Mason was a great defense attorney. He never lost a case.
Never.
Hamilton Burger, how did he not get fired as the DA? He never won a case.
And the other thing was they always confessed on the stand. He always got a confession on the stand. He broke down anyway. So that's what I hid from my mom.
Okay. Good. Safe. All right. Iris, back to you. Okay. So this writing hobby stays with you. And I'm going to fast forward at some point and tell us when this was. You were taking classes in screenwriting, and that's what really kind of launched your career into screenplay and writing for TV and movies and streaming services?
Yes, I would say that, again, it was always a hobby to write. So it was something I just kept up since I was little. And after I graduated with my degrees, I still continued to write on the side. And so I was taking, after work, I would take classes at UCLA in writing fiction. And at first, you know, I was thinking I was going to write a novel.
Of course.
But I could never finish a novel. And, you know, living in LA, it seems like everybody is writing a screenplay. And so I thought, well, maybe I should give that a try.
Well, it's easier, right? Isn't right? Not that I can do either. I can't write a sentence. Not that I could do either, but writing a screenplay is somewhat easier, correct?
It's much shorter. So I could actually finish one because, you know, it was like, don't go over 100 pages was kind of the advice. So I thought, okay, it's only 100 pages and there's a lot of white space. I think I can do this. And, I found that to be a much easier medium at the time. And then I, entered a bunch of contests, and then I won a contest, and one of the judges on that contest was an agent. So that's how I got my foot in the door.
Who's sponsoring these contests, and what was the contest like?
There are a gazillion screenwriting contests out there.
Oh.
And some of them are, you know, they're legitimate. Others are just people getting money, these poor writers. This one was legitimate because you look at who the judges are.
Sure.
And in this case, they were, you know, the agents and representatives. So that was a good one. The one I won was called Big Bear Writing Contest or something. I don't think it's a big one. There's some other big ones like Nichols. And then there's a whole bunch of, I guess, they're contests. All the studios have them, Warner Brothers, Disney, and so on and so forth. To get your foot in the door, especially if you're a minority. This Big Bear Lake was just was an unheard of screenwriting contest at the time.
What did you submit that won and got you on the attention of the agent?
It was called Traveler in Tokyo, and it was a historical piece that took place around World War II. And I call it my Japanese Dead Poet Society because it was about a English literature teacher teaching students in Japan, and then the war breaks out and sort of the dynamics between now he's the enemy and, and he's living in Japan and he's not able to get out and what that was like. But, you know, it's mostly the relationship with the students.
Very cool. Okay, I'm sorry. David first, then Jamie. We'll flip it next time. Did you ever enter any contests, writing or otherwise?
When I was seven, I entered a poetry contest for Ebony Magazine.
Get out! Do you remember what it was? Can you do it?
Yes. Well, it was a silly poem, but I won, so.
Couldn't be silly. What was it? We'll let Iris judge.
I was seven. I don't remember.
What was the topic? Bears?
No, it was
bunny
about
rabbits.
Dumb in classrooms. It was stupid.
Okay, full stop, because I've known David for a long time and many times appeared on Tony Kornheiser's show with David.
Iris, I am so sorry.
This is fascinating.
David,
seven,
you and I have trashed poetry many, many times.
Yes, we have.
Right next to jazz.
How do you think I got to that point in my life?
Okay.
Set to hell with poetry.
Okay, Jamie, any contest?
No, I won a dance contest once, but... Only because I gyrated so much, the judges off. But like David, I wrote a poem in the second grade, It didn't go into a contest, though.
This is going to help both of you get elected.
But I do remember the poem.
Go ahead.
My 7th.
Is it under 10 seconds?
Yes, it is.
Here you go.
It's like, oh, no, I've forgotten it. It's like,
we'll post it later.
Yes, it was, okay, kites are flying in the air all around and everywhere. And it was about kites in the summer.
Wow. This is completely Irish.
I have a copy of it in my own handwriting. I can send you.
I have known both these guys for a long time. You definitely win. Definitely win the poetry contest. And this has completely changed my relationship with these two men. Cause anyways. Okay, Iris. So you win this contest. It gets you on the radar screen of this agent. And this leads you to your first big breakthrough, which is the screenplay for, and it's connected to the book. I promise everybody listening to this is connected to City Under One Roof. But Iris, go.
It was called Letters from Iwo Jima was the name of the movie, but it did take 3 years after I got the representation before that happened. So it wasn't instantaneous.
It wasn't overnight. Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't overnight. and that was just, it was sort of a, well, Paul Haggis is looking for a writer because Paul Haggis was hired by Clint Eastwood to write Flags of Our Fathers.
Right.
And then Clint Eastwood had an idea to also do the Japanese side of the story and, asked Paul Haggis, but he was, you know, he was super busy. I think he was working on Crash at the same time and, you know, he was doing a lot of other things. So he said, well, I'll help you look for a writer. And since his agency was the same as mine at CAA, my agent heard about this project and said, well, you should go and interview for it. And neither of us were expecting anything to happen out of that as an unproduced, unknown writer. But I did do my research because they said, you know, they had an idea for who the main character would be, which was the General Kuribayashi, which was played by Ken Watanabe in the movie.
Yeah.
So they had an idea about him and they sent me, some letters that he had written to his son, some of the real life general.
Yeah.
Had written a number of letters to his son. So that's what I had. And then off of that, I just did a lot of research and came up with a story with a lot of other characters involved and pitched it to first to Paul Haggis, who thought, oh, you know, it's great. And then we went to Clint Eastwood and he thought it was great, too. And it was actually quite easy. And I actually didn't believe that this project was a real movie. We were told it's a companion film to Flags of Our Fathers. And I said, what's that? And is it like an extra on the DVD? And my agent had no clue. I said, maybe.
What was going through your head? What were your feelings when I assume at some point you sat in movie theater and watched the finished product?
Good question.
The feelings kept snowballing because at first, again, I was just under the impression that no one was going to see this movie because it was going to be something on a DVD maybe. And then at some point I asked Paul Haggis, I said, is this going to be in theaters? And he said, yes, it's going to be in theaters. But then at the end, so then I got excited about that, but it was still going to be directed by a Japanese director at the time. It was going to be in Japanese by a Japanese director. So I thought, okay, people in Japan might watch this. And then at some point, I forgot when it was, but Clint Eastwood said that he was going to direct it. And then I got so I was like, wow, people might actually come and see this now, you know, with Clint Eastwood directing it. And I found out that first it was going to be released in February, which is, I think, kind of the slow time in the theater business. And then at some point, it got moved to before the end of the year. Like, I think it was being released in October. And then everybody involved were so happy because that meant somebody thought it was good enough to qualify right. for awards. So that, I mean, just every moment seemed to be, you know, making it bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, watching it in the theater was amazing. I took my father, who had never, as I mentioned, told me not to get involved in writing.
So it was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, right? Including Best Screenplay.
Yes.
You go to the Academy Awards. Most importantly, who did you wear and what was the red carpet like?
Who did I wear? It was something I got from the mall. So I don't remember. I don't think it was a designer dress. I had actually wondered, like, oh, do people, if you're nominated, can you get access to dresses and things like that? But interestingly, not a lot of women at that time were nominated for writing. Yeah. So that wasn't even a consideration.
Yeah.
And I looked at some designer dresses and I'm like, oh my God, that's like my whole salary. So forget it. I just picked up something at the mall.
We've had so many authors on ours who have gone from writing books and then they get turned into Netflix series or movies and those kinds of things. But your transition as a professional from writing with most success, writing screenplays, to this book. So segueing to City Under One Roof, a novel. Tell us how that happened. Tell us how it went from you were thinking this might be a screenplay to no, this might be a novel. And that, you know, tell us about the story. The Jamie McIntyre question. Tell us what the story is about and how you got there.
After getting the nomination, I was sort of, I'm sure writers go through this all the time. You're pegged as a certain type of writer. So I was pegged as the Asian historical writer, which at the time was not very commercial. I think nowadays it's, the climate is better now to tell diverse stories. But back then, nobody wanted to make those movies.
Right.
So I kind of was trying to get out of that pigeonhole. And I started, so I had this idea first as a series for this murder mystery series. I was taking it around town and pitching it, and I had a great producer attached, and it looked good on paper, but we didn't sell it. I had done so much work, because when you're pitching, it's actually a lot of work. Even if you don't write it, the whole story on paper, you have to be able to say what a whole season would look like, and if you wanted to go to a second season, what would that look like? And you really have to plot it all out. So I thought, oh, I've done so much work on this. Why don't I try writing it as a novel? And that's how it got started. And I just remember seeing this documentary like over 20 years ago, because it was before the tunnel was open to car traffic, about this real-life city in Alaska where all the people, the residents, the 200-something residents lived in a single building. And it just felt like, oh, that just seems like a great setting for a murder, for a murder mystery. And it started there. And then as I was doing research, I saw like going through the tunnel, because the only way to the city is through this tunnel, through a mountain. Mm-hmm. And when you drive through the tunnel, it's very claustrophobic. It's just one lane. It switches directions every half hour. So it felt like I was falling through a hole and I was going to end up in some strange wonderland that was full of strange people. And that's what kind of set off the idea of creating characters that would kind of be in a strange town, in a strange wonderland.
When I first heard of the setting, I thought, well, this is kind of contrived. And then I read, no, actually a place like this really exists, which makes the book sort of even more tantalizing, if I can use that word. I just thought it was fascinating that you were able to take this real life town and see the potential for all the things that could go wrong in that kind of a setting.
Iris, I went to look for the documentary that you had talked about, and I could not find that. But not too long ago, CBS Sunday Morning, whatever that show is called now, did a thing on, it's based on Whittier, Alaska, and did a thing on the town and talked about the tunnel and talked about all living in the building, World War II, those kinds of things, and interviewed a few people. And I went, oh, could totally be in Iris's book. That one, okay, she could totally be in, there was an Amy in Iris's book, which is fantastic. So talk about your favorite characters in your book, and there are so many wonderful people, and how much your screenplay writing coming from that kind of medium to this one influenced how you wrote about them, portrayed them, executed them, etc.?
The jumping off point for the characters was actually Alice in Wonderland. So I was trying to make analogies. The detective woman who comes into town is like Alice falling through the hole, ending up there. And then I have two other voices. I have Lonnie and I have Amy. And I think of Amy sometimes as the white rabbit that Kara has to chase after for clues. Mm-hmm. And I think of Lonnie as the Mad Hatter character, because she speaks in word salads and she has
great hands.
And she wears a different color beret every day. So that's where that came from. And then I have some other characters that will come in again in the second book, in the sequel.
Which is very, very exciting. David, question, comment?
I was curious about isolation, which is a character in this in this book, right? Yeah. I mean, it's a definite character. And if isolation was something that you knew about or thought about, or if it was something you had to kind of lean into and research and think and talk to other people about or research about, because I'm a city kid. I need concrete. I need sirens. I need noise to be able to function. I could not. But I get that there are people, millions, hundreds of millions of people in the world that it's anathema to them. It's horrific to them to be in crowds and to be amongst people. And I just wonder how you thought about isolation as a character in the book.
It's kind of funny because I started the ideas and started writing the book before COVID hit. And then, I want to try to describe what it's like. But then after COVID hit, I'm like, well, now everybody knows what it must be like, you know, to live here. But obviously, as a writer, you always try to put your head into the characters. And of course, when I started writing the book, I felt like, you know, I don't understand why anyone would want to live here. But once you get into the put yourself in their mindset, you can see what pros there might be. In the book's case, you know, everyone here has something to hide. That's what I just imagined, that if you were choosing this place, you could have been running away from something, or, you know, you might have something to hide. And that's what this community could be about, is the secrets. And they have to rely on each other and keep each other's secrets and things like that.
One of the things I loved, Iris, in the book, is you meet these characters. I'm thinking of the chief right now, police chief right now. And you might not like them right away, but then as the book goes on, things are revealed and you go, okay, now I understand that. Was that deliberate on your part when you introduced characters? Did you know how they were going to end up, or how did that flow out of you in your writing?
I didn't know what their secrets were when I started. Like, I knew that they probably all have secrets. And so as I was writing, I was trying to figure out what their secrets were. And then, you know, you go back and you rewrite sections to make it work. This was one of your questions earlier with the screenwriting coming into the book writing, is, you know, you learn a lot about the character developments and, you know, trying to have arcs for characters, so that they're not one-dimensional. You know, you want to try and figure out that someone might not seem like a good person in the beginning, and, you know, they may not be a good person in general, but that they have, you know, you have to understand them as a character. You have to understand their motivations. You have to understand how they got there, things like that.
I have no idea if this is true or not, but as somebody who has binged-watched pretty much everything that has ever appeared since the pandemic started, I feel like I'm an authority on this. But often if you see something happen, you go, remember that, because that's going to come back. And there's a finite amount of time, whether you're talking movie, TV, screen, you know, streaming, whatever. There's a every scene, every shot has to have a purpose. And I didn't realize it as I was reading the book, but then I listened to it in my car and I went, oh my God, that's why we saw that or heard that. Is that where your previous experience before you wrote a novel helped? Because I think every sentence in the book, every paragraph is with a purpose.
Yeah, you learn kind of a succinctness in screenwriting because you only have so much time. And that, yes, when you put something there, there should be a reason. But sometimes I've written things and I was working with a writer's group because it's more fun.
Every
that
writer
way.
Does.
So people read pages and then you can hear it and it's a lot more fun. Where I didn't initially have a purpose and they're going, that's going to come back, isn't it? And I'd be like, I didn't think so. But now that you've said that, I better make it come back.
Every time somebody coughs in a show I'm watching, I think they're going to die or become very sick later. Because otherwise, why waste the time with somebody coughing on the show?
Yeah.
I'm curious, now that you've produced this as a novel, can you reverse engineer it now back into a screenplay for a limited series on Netflix or HBO or Amazon or whatever, wherever they screen these things these days?
Yes, it's definitely a goal. So knocking on wood and hoping that it does happen. I don't control that so much. I mean, my agent is sending it out and then we'll see what happens.
Because it definitely seems like a series I would watch.
Totally.
Oh, totally.
And I would probably binge watch it in a day and a half.
Yeah.
Assuming it was only 8 episodes. And let's go into season 2.
Okay, I'll have my agent send this recording to all the producers.
Oh, it screams a great limited series. It screams it. And Iris, you know LA. You live in LA. You work in LA. You know all those people. My God. Like you know. Broke into the business with Clint Eastwood, for God's sake. You must have actors in your mind when you go, oh. Now, did they come to your mind after you had written it or as you were writing it? Because Jessica Chastain would be a fabulous, or Jennifer Lawrence would be fabulous as Kara, our protagonist, by the way, just offering that up.
The funny thing is I don't actually think of actors when I'm writing the story, because sometimes I do, but I've learned that I'll be disappointed. Get the A-list actors. So I just, you know, just hope for the best and try to make them so that a lot of actors could play that character.
Absolutely.
Some of your best A-list actors were once B-list, C-list, or D-list actors.
Exactly.
That's true.
But also, I think this would, you're going to get, I'm not saying if you get, you're going to get really high quality actors who will want something that causes them to step up, because the physical limitations of the scene is primarily this building, a little bit on the outskirts of the building, but that means they actually have to act well. They actually have to be able to carry off some dialogue. There's a ton of dialogue in this story that requires some actual acting, which is fabulous.
I'm fascinated by the fact that you were inspired somewhat or derived some of this from Alice in Wonderland, because that strikes me as the kind of thing, if I read a novel in college and I wrote an essay about it and I compared it to Alice in Wonderland, my professor would say, you know, no, this is nonsense. You know, you've got it all wrong. And then, like that scene in Annie Hall, I would be able to pull you out from behind the bandit.
You know nothing of my work.
Yeah, he said, like, well, it just so happens I have Iris right here. And she said, you know.
I have a lot of Easter eggs that I've written in there that are Alice in Wonderland Easter eggs. A lot of people don't seem to think that's important, or, you know, they don't care. But I think because, you know, I'm kind of geeky that way, I get such a thrill out of it. I have them in the first book and the second book. There's a lot of, there's characters in there and there's,
this makes me want to, I will listen to, I'm going to be in the car tomorrow for a long time going to the NHL draft. I'm going to listen to this again, Iris, because I want to find the Easter eggs. That's fantastic. And maybe as part of the bonus content that goes along with the Netflix series, there could be a guide for idiots who don't find the Easter eggs for the Easter eggs.
Oh, that would be so much fun. I mean, I know it's easier to come up with them than to actually find them, but to come up with them is a lot of fun. So
even if nobody
gets it, it's fun.
Might have to read Alice's Adventures in Wonderland again too. I wanted to ask you about your last name, and Tori pronounced it at the beginning of the show. It's
Yamashita.
Yamashita
is the Japanese way of saying it, but I used to just say Yamashita. Is it easier to pronounce that way?
Yeah, no, I pronounce it the way it should be pronounced.
Because in English, that's what people would like. And it just reminded me when I was at CNN, I was doing a story in Japan at a naval base, and I signed off Jamie McIntyre, CNN, Yokosuka, Japan. And my producer came up to me and she said, Jamie, that was really good, except that it's pronounced Yokosuka. In Japanese, they don't accent it that way. And when I saw your name, it reminded me of that. And I thought, I bet that's how it's pronounced.
There you go. Okay, Mr. Aldridge, before we subject Iris Yamashita to 60 seconds more, any closing thoughts, questions, comments?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. excuse me. The
COVID.
Oh, he's going to die.
COVID.
He coughed.
No,
he's going to die.
COVID.
Oh,
not
my
COVID,
gosh.
Not COVID. I am always fascinated, because remember we had Dennis Lehane on a few weeks ago? And of course, Dennis Lehane was author, and you talked about this a little, Tori, but just making that transition where every word, they're your words, whether it's a screenplay or a novel, they're your words. And I wondered which ones had more value for you. Were they screenplay words or were they novel words?
That's an interesting question.
Because they're very different, obviously.
Screenplays, more people will actually watch the work, watch them, I suppose. But in my case, it was in Japanese. So maybe the novel, I would say the novel because it's in English.
Yeah.
What I had originally written was translated for the movie. So I guess I would have to say the novel. The other thing is that I would say that in screenwriting, a lot of times you're working on not original material. In Letters from Iwo Jima, I was given the original screenplay credit because I did have reference material, but it was nonfiction reference, and so I created the characters and things. But after that movie, I've gotten a lot of projects come my way, but they're usually adaptations or someone else's work. So novels are fun in that they're all original.
Yeah.
So I actually enjoy writing novels more.
In some ways, it's unpredictable what's going to stick out in a movie script, and sometimes it's even an ad-libbed line from an actor. But I remember reading that the author who wrote the screenplay for A League of Their Own had no idea that the line, "There's no crying in baseball," would be like the most memorable line from the movie. He was kind of a throwaway line.
Right.
He was completely taken aback when that became sort of the catchphrase of that movie.
Well, that's what I meant, because movies are so much more visceral, I think, than novels, right? Like, they really go through you if they're good. If you garner meaning from them, right? Like that.
Yeah.
And I just wondered about that, because you could write something, whether it becomes a catchphrase or it's just a really good line in a movie, right? And it just cuts to the audience's soul almost, right? Like, in a way that books are just different. It's like TV and newspapers. One's not better than the other. They're just different. They're just really different ways of writing.
David, you had me at hello.
Yeah.
I think I have a friend who can quote movie quotes all day long, but I doubt if he would quote anything from a book. So
I want someone to explain to me why boys, and I've got 220-somethings and 160-something in my house, boys, the stupidest movies on the planet. David's laughing. Stupidest movies on the planet. They can recite every single line. If you say to them, do you remember yesterday I asked you, we've got this really important thing that we need to do? They could not remember if you put a gun to their head.
No.
Well, for someone like me, for someone my age, it's Godfather. You can quote from The Godfather today, all of the movies. Or Casablanca. You can quote 6 or 7 lines from Casablanca.
Okay, that has some class. What I'm talking about with my boys, what my boys can quote is Caddyshack.
Oh, yeah, Billy Madison. Oh, sure.
Animal House. Okay. Yes, okay.
So I got that going for me.
It's a miracle that we've evolved. I'm just telling you, Tori. I just
haven't.
Yes, I was perfect.
This is a shot of luck that we're still that we're not knuckle dragging anymore. It's just, I don't know.
All right, we should let Iris go and not further subject her to
So she can curse out the person that put her on the show.
Because we need a tiny little bit more content. Oh my gosh, we've kept her longer than we should have. So Iris, we're going to subject you to what we call 60 seconds more, which is like buy the book in the Sunday New York Times book section, but without the pretense. So you ready? And David, by the way, I'm getting pretty close to 60 seconds, by the way.
You are nowhere close to 60 seconds, but go ahead.
Screw you. Screw you. All right. You ready, Iris?
Okay.
Favorite childhood book. I hope it's Alice in Wonderland.
Actually, Wizard of Oz, I would say.
Okay, good. Good, close. Favorite classic, least favorite classic. And if you say none of the above, that's okay.
I remember Little Women having a big effect on me as a kid. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Somebody could write a book about the interesting effect on a very diverse number of people who really like that book, that series. That's interesting. Okay. It's more fun to write about the bad guys or the good guys. And there are quasi-good guys and there are quasi-bad guys in City Under One Roof.
It's more fun to write the shady, the shades of gray characters.
Yeah.
They're not good. They're not bad.
Okay. What's harder? Because I know you have taught screenwriting at UCLA. What is harder, teaching screenwriting or writing a novel?
Teaching screenwriting.
Yeah. You could see the look on her face. For those watching on News Channel 8, the look on her face gave that one away right away. Okay. What's on your nightstand, which nobody has anymore, waiting to be read?
I have a lot. I guess my Kindle is on my nightstand. I have a bunch in my Kindle, including some of your former guests on the show, including Anna Reyes's book, and House in the Pines, and Alma Katsu's Red London are both
great.
In my Kindle list.
Fabulous. So if you couldn't write, this is the last question, and then seriously, we'll let you go. If you could only write about one topic, would it be this crime mystery genre?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Okay. No rom-coms in your future?
No. Yeah. Definitely not.
Okay.
Is there a meet cute in this book?
There's a meet cute. It's kind of weird, but there's a meet cute.
There is a romance.
Yeah, a little weird.
I would say I'm not good at it.
Well, I feel like I failed in the show in City Under One Roof and not talking about Denny the Moose. But people, listen to this. One of the many, many, many reasons to get this book at your favorite independent bookstore is because Denny the Moose is spectacular. Tiny bit of housekeeping. So we are off next week, 4th of July. Happy 4th, everybody. Then we're back. David Aldrich, did you know David Mondrilli from the Washington Post?
You know, we were actually, I'm pretty sure were we in the same internship class? We may have been.
Wow.
It was a long time ago. Yes.
Okay.
I think we were.
Well, I love him because we'll discuss when he's on the show. He is back with us. He has this incredible book and it's called The Book of Charlie, Wisdom from the Remarkable American Life of a 109-year-old man. He's a neighbor. And David, who just really interesting life and has seen a lot in his own time, wrote this fabulous book. So he's coming back with us. In the meantime, everybody, go get City Under One Roof, a novel. And thank you for listening. And we will see you all soon.